This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right. Good evening, everyone. It's been such a privilege to meet with you. And you all had so many questions even after the talk last time, and good questions, too, that I might not predict. So tonight, we're going to try to pull things together a little bit in the series, and we're also going to try to bring it home a little bit in the sense of realizing this is mini medical school. And so if you're a doctor or a patient, what are some of the essential questions that people might ask? But thank you all for coming again, and let's get started. So this is now week 6. You have had your introduction to immunology. You've been through bugs and drugs. You've been through genomes and genes. And now we're in the 6th and final week of Immunology 201. That means you're at least juniors now, right? So in Immunology 101, as we take a look back to kind of review and remind ourselves of some of the things that we learned, there are a number of key concepts that we had. We learned that the immune system works on our behalf every moment of our lives. Someone over here last time asked me the question, exactly when does immune function start? And I knew approximately, and maybe that's all we can know, but like any good student, I went back and looked things up because I'm not a pediatrician, I'm an internist, so I don't have some of those questions quite as accurately as someone who specializes in pediatric immunology. But you know what? The immune system is well on its way by 12 weeks after conception. It's quite early, and some of it actually starts even earlier than that, maybe even in the 5th week, and a little bit of it actually starts in the liver before the bone marrow. So there's so much to learn all the time, even for myself. But I'm starting off by answering a question last time that I couldn't answer very well. The immune system defends us against external, such as pathogens or bacteria, microbes, and internal threats all the time. Do you remember an example of one of those internal threats? Yes. Yeah, cancer cells can be an internal threat, and our immune system generally squashes those down. That's one of the jobs of the immune system. Major cells of the immune system start in the bone marrow. Remember, we talked about the bone marrow. And then they move all around the body to do their job. So there's a lot of movement, a lot of signaling. In our whole lives, we have new cells that are forming and going to do their work. The ability of the immune system to work properly is affected not only by genetics, as you all have learned in the last couple of weeks, but also by the environment. And we'll try to look at a couple examples of that tonight. Okay? Remember, we had some vocabulary, and part of that was the lymphatic system. Remember our vocabulary in orange? The lymphatic system is really some of the major sites of immune activity. Okay, so as we talked about before, many of the cells of the immune system, start in the bone marrow. Okay? From the bone marrow, they'll move to other parts of the body. Some of those parts of the body might include lymph nodes. Lymph nodes occur all over the body, and particularly at sites of interaction with the outer environment. T lymphocytes, some of the main regulators of the immune system, actually go from the bone marrow to an organ called the thymus. Remember hearing about the thymus right behind the breastbone? It's much larger in kids than adults. And in the thymus, it's kind of a way station. It's a checkpoint. Okay, you have to pass several checkpoints. You thought Stanford was hard to get into. It's nothing like being a baby T lymphocyte and trying to make it into a mature one. It's probably 5% or fewer of all the lymphocytes that start pass all the checkpoints in the thymus to be released into the body. And what's the term? Remember the term for programmed cell death? Oh, you guys are so good. Apoptosis, some people call it apoptosis, more fun to say that way. But yes, programmed cell death. And so most of the thymocytes, baby T cells that go into the thymus, are actually rejected for one reason or another. So the immune system is picky, and probably as picky or pickier than some of the highest colleges. Unlike the highest colleges, however, which do not kill you if you don't get in, your immune system will with programmed cell death. Okay, good thing. If you're rejected, they don't kill you too. That's a good thing. Okay, so lots of parts in the body are focus sites for immune cells. Keep in mind tonsils. See that one right there? Remember, if you see a small child with no tonsils, that is not a good sign, because the tonsils are mostly developing lymph cells, and especially B lymphocytes. Okay? So in a small child, large tonsils are normal. All right, let's remind ourselves about those cells. So in the development of cells, we have the stem cells, which start where? Bone marrow, okay? And I like to think of it as two major categories. Your stem cells might develop into the lymphoid lines of cells, which would include T lymphocytes or T cells, B lymphocytes, or natural killer cells, okay? So if they're not called lymphocytes, the other ones are pretty easy to remember, because all the rest of them are derived from myeloid cells. That includes dendritic cells, basophils, macrophages, all these other ones on the other side. Those are all of myeloid lineage, and we're going to hear a little bit more about those just for our review in just a minute. So these immune cells go different places and do different things, but the key immune cells might go in several easily described places. They might be sentinel cells, which live in tissue sites, and they're there also kind of as a way station to check things out, make sure everything's going okay, and in case there is something they need to pay attention to, they do their job. So they stay fairly localized. There are circulating cells, neutrophils, monocytes, eosinophils, lymphocytes, which you saw on the previous slide. These tend to circulate around in the blood, and they respond to chemical signals. So if you get a cut or something on your hand, the local immune system sends out signals. Eventually, those signals will recruit inflammatory cells to that site. Those that are circulating in the blood, they actually work their way through the blood, go to that local site, and then they do their duty. Okay, so some cells are relatively fixed, some circulate around and go where help is needed, and then there are others like tissue cells that are actually part of our structure, but nevertheless they do play a role in immunity. Is the mic okay? I'm hearing a little bit of on and off. Okay, I'll try not to turn very much here. Okay. So let's remind ourselves about the general time course of the immune response. The immune response consists of innate immunity. We reviewed that, which is really what happens very quickly, within hours. The early induced response, which is generally that initial recognition of what's going on and trying to recruit inflammatory cells. And the adaptive immune response, which really takes a number of days to occur. So what you would like is, if you have a pathogen invading you, you would like some really fast response, right? You don't want to have to wait 4 days to be able to mount a response. By then, you'll be eaten. So there are different parts of the immune system that are designed to respond very quickly, and others that take a little while to kick in. And these are terms that we had talked about last time. Okay, in summary of the innate immunity, so we're just zipping right through what we learned on the first talk here. There are all different kinds of mechanisms that we have to protect ourselves right up front before the specific adaptive immunity kicks in. So if you happen to swallow something with bacteria on it, right away that saliva acts as a little bit of a barrier to prevent bacteria or viruses from attaching to our tissue. Okay? If you swallow it and it goes in the stomach, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to sit in a bowl of acid for, 20, 30 minutes churning around in a big bowl of acid, which is what's in the stomach. That's not a very pleasant environment for anyone, and microbes don't like that either. There also is microbiological competition. So last time we talked about how many different organisms we have on our skin, in our gut, all over our bodies that are there normally, and they're healthy. And guess what? Any of these microbes that you come in contact with have to compete with all these other organisms, and they're in a sea of millions and billions of organisms, and it's hard for them to have exact access to where they want to go. So even the fact that we have a lot of normal organisms on us and in us actually serves as a kind of defense. And there are a few other things that we mentioned as well as far as innate immunity. One other thing I wanted to remind you about was the movie that we saw that was about this term phagocytosis. Remember that? I showed you a video of a neutrophil that was chasing Staph aureus, a kind of bacteria, and eventually engulfed it. And you could tell that Staph aureus just didn't have a prayer of a chance, right? So that's also part of innate immunity. There are some cells that are designed to recognize who looks abnormal, doesn't belong there, and just engulf them and then process them from there. Okay, so all sorts of cool ways that we have of dealing with organisms that don't belong there. A couple more of our vocabulary words. We talked about antigens and antibodies. So really, simply speaking, antigens are things that trigger an immune response, if you want to make it really general. But a lot of times we use that term more specifically to mean things that trigger an immune response with antibodies. And the antibodies are the protein that the B lymphocytes produce in response to that trigger. Okay, is this sounding familiar? Remember all this that we went through? Okay, so antigens and antibodies, but because this is just so incredible, I wanted to just show you this slide once more, where this particular antibody and every single antibody has this antigen binding site here, and it recognizes one specific antigen, okay? And there are just millions and billions of antigens and specific antibodies. It is incredible. So there are antigens and there are antibodies that recognize one specific antigen, something that triggers an immune response. So going back to our slide of the cells, I just wanted to remind you that it's these B lymphocytes that produce the antibodies. Okay? But it's not quite as simple as I've put on that slide, so I wanted to just show you a slightly more complex version of it, but there's really so much more involved than what I'm showing you on these slides. You see down here is the B lymphocyte with antibody production, but these B lymphocytes get instructions from T lymphocytes to do that. One of the things that we didn't talk about in the short time that we had together before was cytokines. And cytokines are essentially chemical signals that provide instructions about which part of the immune system should become active. And so if you get the cytokines that induce lymphocytes to mature and produce antibodies, that's what you get. On the other hand, if it's a different kind of organism, if it's an organism that hides inside the cells, it may not be antibodies that you want. It might be that you want to activate your macrophages, in which case a different set of cytokines would come along and activate that part of the immune system depending on what the stimulus is. Okay, does that make sense? Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Is the communication system one way?
Is the communication system one way? That is a great question, and the answer is no, it's not. There are definitely some parts of it that can go one way, but there are often feedback mechanisms where if certain kinds of cells are activated, they also will send out cytokines informing other parts of the immune system about what to do. So it is an absolutely great question. It's a very complex topic, but in fact, you're absolutely right that once one part of the immune system is activated, there may be more chemical signals that come out of that cell, for example, that induce more of that activity or another activity. Okay? Very insightful question. Okay, so I have a really cool video for you this time. So remember how we talked about the B and T cells interacting, and that for the B cells to produce their antibodies, they need to receive certain signals. One of the signals actually is very specific cell-cell interaction. Okay, so what is it that actually happens in the human for this to occur? Okay, let's see if we can do this. So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at T cells in green. I remember that on this video because I think of green tea. Anyway, we all have our ways that we remember things. But the T cells, the T lymphocytes are in green, and the red ones are the B lymphocytes. Okay? And actually, before I even run the video, you can see that some of them are already communicating with each other, which isn't the normal state of things unless there really has been activation. Then you really see it. So let's see if I can actually turn this on. I'm not sure I can here. Let's see what's going on. There we go. Okay. This is occurring over about an hour. This is in a lymph node, and you can see that there's this ongoing communication between B and T cells, and the T cells are undoubtedly providing instructions to the B cells about what to do. And this is what happens when there is stimulation by antigens, right? Okay, so the antigens create a process in the immune system where all these communication signals get sent. And here we've got T and B lymphocytes actually communicating with each other, and this has been seen. And how they did this was to actually attach a dye so that they knew specifically which cell was the T cell, which one was the B cell. This is courtesy of the Public Library of Science, and also a colleague of mine, Jason Sister, who runs a lab here at UCSF, and this is his whole life about communication with B cells and lymph nodes. Okay. So this is also another video. If you take a step back in the lymph node, it gives you an idea of how many cells are there. And let me just comment that this is one little tiny piece of tissue in one little tiny piece of a lymph node in one tiny part of a body. And this is happening all over the body every moment of every day. And this is just a little tiny thing, but this is going on all the time. Okay, you think you're sleeping? No way. Your immune system is working the whole time. Okay. So there we go. So you can see that not all the B cells are interacting with the T cells, and they don't always interact with each other all the time. But once you do have stimulation, then you do see a lot more of that interaction and communication among them. So that's actually what the immune system does. That's pretty cool, isn't it, that you can see that? Okay, moving right along, lymphocytes. So after identification of the invaders, the lymphocytes generate an immunologic response that specifically and maximally targets that pathogen, talking about infections here. And they also generate memory cells for the future. So if you have a particular bacteria that attacks you, it's great to have a response like this, but wouldn't it be a bummer if every time that bacteria attacked you, you had to mount this whole new response over and over again and have another 3 or 4 or 5 days before you could do it? Well, the immune system's taking care of that. That's what the adaptive response is all about. And part of that adaptive response is memory cells, so that the next time that particular antigen organism comes along, that particular stimulus, your immune system is ready for it. Okay? And how do we do that? How do we take advantage of that in the real world? Vaccines. Okay? That's what a vaccine does. So the vaccine fools your immune system into thinking that you've had an infection. You develop memory, so the next time that particular real bug comes along, your immune system can take care of it much more quickly. Yes, sir? Yeah, so the question is regarding what is it that happens when something new comes along? And really, that's the innate immune system. So the innate immune system, the things that I talked about to begin with, that is how any kind of new antigen or organism is addressed. If it's recognized as not me, then the innate immune system does its duty. Some of it by just because that the mucus is there, but sometimes there are more active constituents in the mucus that are designed to address somebody who's new and different that comes along. So that's really the innate immune system, and the lymph nodes become active when the outer parts of the immune system, let's say if you have a skin infection, there's communication that happens that goes that involves directly to the nearest, sorry, I'm thinking about how to best explain this, to the nearest lymph node, and then it's in the lymph node where the major decisions are made about how to respond to it.
I mean, if something gets past all that, so you're into the adaptive system, how does the adaptive
Yeah, so if it gets past the immune system, the initial part of the immune system, how does it adapt? Well, that's where we can run into bad disease processes. You know, if you wind up in the intensive care unit with pneumonia, it's because somehow the bacteria or virus that infected you was able to get past all of those initial defenses, and maybe you did not get your pneumonia vaccine, or maybe you didn't get your influenza vaccine, so you don't have the help or the benefit from there. And so, yes, you mount an immune response, but it might take a number of days to occur. And in most cases, it's able to do that, and usually it's going to be decision-making on the part of those T lymphocytes about how to address it. Most of the time, we're able to battle it off. Sometimes we can't. And as Dr. Kruettering was talking about, that's what when we enlist the help of antibiotics, when it seems like the infection's getting the better of us. Yes, so how does the adaptive response occur? Yeah, so there are signals that are given based upon the sort of the appearance. There's a part of the immune system we didn't go into in detail in the innate immunity called pattern recognition receptors. And they do make an initial assessment about sort of the general appearance of this particular pathogen. And then as part of that innate immune response, they might take the whole organism or a piece of it and actually present it inside the lymph node to the T cell. So it is literally, in most cases, presented to these T lymphocytes, which make decisions about how to orchestrate the response. Okay, we can go into that in a little bit detail later on afterwards as well. Yeah, you guys are absolutely right. This process is extremely complex, but at the same time, incredible. And it's hard to make heads or tails of it sometime and explain it briefly. Yes, sir. So the question is regarding if somebody is going to undergo a procedure that might have an effect on the immune system, could we ahead of time take out some lymphocytes or part of the immune system and give it back later on? Can we harvest them in the lab? Not in any meaningful way, except in some cases. For example, 5 weeks ago I introduced you to Elizabeth, and that's an example where we can give immunoglobulin antibodies to someone who needs them who does not make them. So yes, in some cases we can do that, but it's very difficult with the lymphocytes because keep in mind that all these things are very specific for all these different antigens that come along. So you don't have one antibody that's going to be effective against many different things. Each antibody is going to have its own individual antigen that it's designed for. So the way that I would say we do use that, which doesn't exactly apply to what you're mentioning, is, for example, in patients with lymphoma who get a stem cell transplant. We might use some of the cells that we know are good cells from that person, kind of take care of them while that person undergoes the bone marrow ablation to get rid of the lymphoma, if that's what's necessary, and then give them back their own cells, because we know they won't reject their own cells, right? So, yes, there is precedence for that particular notion, but it's not really that usable for an infection, unfortunately. So, but that's a great idea. I just love working with you guys because you have all these excellent ideas and worth thinking about. Okay, so that's just a brief review of what we talked about in our first week with Dr. Kruettering Hall. You did bugs and drugs for a couple of weeks. So I looked at her slides as well, and the main thing I think that I got out of her excellent slides was that it's easy to kill bacteria, viruses, and other invading organisms. That's easy. We can do that. We can kill just about any of these organisms. Okay, no big deal. What's the hard part? Yeah, the hard part is not killing ourselves in the process, right? Because whether we like it or not, we have a lot in common with bacteria and viruses, parasites. We do have a lot in common. So we have to come up with ways that we create antibacterial or antiviral, antifungal organisms that specifically target the differences between us and them. Okay, that's the hard part. So we can kill organisms, but the hard part is killing them and not us, and that's not an easy thing. You guys also talked about bacteria, and some of the differences, such as bacterial cell walls. Okay? And so you talked about how we can take advantage of certain structures and functions of pathogens in order to help to get rid of them with the antimicrobials that we have. Now, remember that video with the neutrophil that swallowed the Staph aureus? That Staph aureus, was that inside or outside a cell? It was outside the cell, right? So it makes sense that if you want to avoid the immune system, what do? You go into a cell, okay? It's much harder to take care of somebody that's hiding in the cell because a lot of the things that we talked about, especially in the innate immune system, have a harder time. And also, you know, we don't want to kill our own cells, right? So viruses can be very sneaky and very hard. So isn't it very clever to find a way that you can attach to one of the host cells, host i.e. human cells, get inside of it, and not only hide in there, but then usurp the host cell's structures and activities and do what you want with it, make yourself better and stronger, and then multiply and release with more of these virus particles. Okay, so that viruses have just been taken a huge toll on humans throughout our existence. You had an overview of the drug targets. And for example, when you take penicillin, penicillin really inhibits cell wall synthesis. You remember some of those things where you were talking about the different ways that the antibiotics, antifungal agents, all the different areas, mechanisms by which these agents can work. And you also talked about how it's getting harder and harder to design new treatments that the organisms aren't outsmarting us. So we need all of you young people who are interested in this to come up with new ways that we can outsmart these organisms because, you know, there are theories about extinction of species occurring because of viral infections, and viruses are very efficient. Just as an aside, you all probably have heard about smallpox, which has essentially been wiped out since the late 70s, although there's still some smallpox in laboratories around the world. But when smallpox epidemics occurred, it could wipe out millions, literally millions, sometimes a third of the population, and it was fast. So it's amazing that somehow we survived to today. You also discussed the concept of drug resistance and the need for all of us to play an active role in its prevention and delay. So I have a question for you. What are some examples that you can think of our actions that lead to antibiotic resistance? You remember some of the things that you talked about? What are the things that we might do wrong that lead to antibiotic resistance? Yes?
Not completing your course of medication.
Yeah, because if you only take a little bit of it and you don't really get rid of the bacteria that's there, it can come back stronger and resistant to that antibiotic. And that's a bummer when you start running out of antibiotics that are effective for your infection. Okay, what else might we do that leads to resistance? Yes, ma'am?
What about antibiotics that you feed animals and you leave the animals?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's a topic of a lot of discussion and research. Antibiotics that are fed to animals, and what effect does that have on our ability to be able to then later on take that antibiotic and use it effectively. So yes, these are a couple of examples of things that we do as individuals that maybe make a difference in the development of antibiotic resistance. The other thing that's really important is a lot of people go to their doctors with a cold, an upper respiratory infection, and most colds are caused by what kind of bugs? You guys are great. Viruses. And are antibiotics good against viruses?
No.
No, you guys are excellent. So there are some antiviral organisms. There are agents. Specifically, influenza comes to mind immediately. If you develop influenza and you see the doctor fast enough, as you know, there are some anti-influenza medications that can be given now. So our ability to maintain medications that are effective really depends in large part on us. So that was one of the take-home messages that I had. Okay, now Dr. Hyland talked about genes, genomes, and human disease. So the key concepts in that talk, I think maybe I really liked her analogy about the book. Okay, that was kind of a helpful way of thinking about the role of the different parts of the genome. So if you think of your human genome as being the entire book, and that's kind of the story about you, then you can think about chromosomes as being chapters in that book. Chapters are made up of words, which would be the genes, right? And genes are made up of deoxyribonucleic acid, which would be the letters. Okay, so that's just a recollection of sort of the scope of things when it comes to our genetics. But I also wanted to review briefly, because this is very important with respect to our patient Elizabeth, about alleles. So you remember that she discussed alleles, that we have homologous chromosomes. Okay, we have two. And then in the green here, this represents a locus, which means a particular site on a chromosome, okay, a particular location. It's like an address. And then at the locus, we have these individual alleles, the genes, the programming information. Those are called the alleles, okay? Green stands for wild type, which, even though it's called wild type, is actually sort of normal human variants, okay? Red stands for one kind of mutation, and blue is another mutation. So the terminology is that you have a homozygous, meaning both of them, wild type, both greens, heterozygous, mutant of mutation 1. Okay, you have one normal, one mutant. The next one is what? A homozygous mutant, because you have the same mutated gene on both alleles. So it's homozygous, right? Is that bringing back some recollection there? And then the last one, this person actually has... this is a mutation, and this is a mutation. So the term for that is compound heterozygous. Okay? I know the whole genetics thing is very complex, but these are some of the basics with respect to mutations. Consequences of genetic variation really vary. And one example at one end of the spectrum might be a mutation that has a high impact on the individual. So I remember I was in medical school. Cystic fibrosis was not a good diagnosis to have. Patients with cystic fibrosis would have problems with their pancreas, not producing enzymes to break down food. They would get a lot of diarrhea. They would have a lot of problems with their lungs. Their lungs don't work properly. Their fluids aren't quite right, so they would get lots of infections. And we didn't have great treatments, although antibiotics were helpful. We have many treatments now. Many patients with cystic fibrosis live a long time, and because we know more about genetics, we know there are variants of cystic fibrosis that are much less deadly than most of the ones that used to kill people at a very early age. So cystic fibrosis is an example of a genetic mutation that can have a very high impact on the organism. And beyond that, it can just run the gamut. So there might be some that are multifactorial. There might be multiple genes involved, and maybe you inherited some genes but not others that make you susceptible to things like diabetes or stroke. Or maybe it's something less important. I'm pretty happy with my hazel-colored eyes. I think that's fine. I suppose it could be a problem if you really, really wanted to have blue eyes and you actually have hazel eyes, although I guess you can get colored contacts now if you want to fix that. But that's an example of what we call as a polymorphism, where these are things that are more of just sort of normal differences, and that's what makes us all individuals. So we have what we call neutral variants, okay? So common, low impact on health. Now, if it's something that has a high impact on health, we generally call it a mutation. Okay, if it's something that really doesn't have as much of an impact on health, it's called a polymorphism. So usually mutations are limited to about 1%. Okay, so that's your review there. And then very briefly, spectrum of genetic and environmental factors that lead to disease. And again, an example of where genes are really prominent in how the disease or how the individual lives his or her life might be cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome. If you have those genes, you probably have very predictable changes to your life and the types of illnesses that you have. Whereas in contrast, many diseases are multifactorial and involve a lot of environmental things as well. And here, a great example is measles. Have you heard the term, I caught the measles? Okay, so we catch the measles. We're not born with measles, right? So that's an example of something that we acquire from the environment. Not so much anymore because of vaccines, but it's not something that's really genetic. Although perhaps there might be some kind of susceptibility to how bad you get your measles or something like that. So catching measles is an example of something that's really much more environmentally influenced than something like cystic fibrosis. You talked about different ways that you can do genetic testing. And you talked about single genes, chromosomes, and whole genomes. I'm not going to go back there for now. Okay, so let us talk about Elizabeth. Remember Elizabeth? Okay, so Elizabeth has a primary immune deficiency, implying it's not something that she acquired along the way. What is an example of an acquired immune deficiency? Yes, HIV, okay? HIV is an acquired immune deficiency, meaning that individual probably was born with a normal immune system or some variant of a normal immune system, but along came a what kind of organism? A virus that hides where? Inside the cell. And which cells do those viruses hide in? In particular, T cells. Also some other cells, but T cells. You're starting to make the connection that we've talked about viruses hiding in cells. In the case of HIV, it would be T lymphocytes mostly and predominantly. But in Elizabeth's case, she has a primary immune deficiency. She was born with a problem with her immune system, and as time passed, it was recognized that this just was not normal. She had way too many infections, but they were kind of all characteristic and the same types of infections over and over. So Elizabeth does not make antibodies, okay, which we reviewed briefly again tonight. And so actually the kinds of infections she might get are fairly predictable depending on what we know about what antibodies do. Okay, so antibodies work a little differently than other parts of the immune system. So when we know it's just antibodies that she doesn't have, we can predict to some extent what kinds of infections and problems she'll have. So are we starting to make some connections here about all these things that we've been talking about? All right, so in the right situation, antibiotics can be life-saving for her. Now, I didn't put these in orange, but these are actually very important medical words for those of you who are going into medical fields. Morbidity means what? Illness, okay? It's something that makes you sick. And mortality means what? Death, okay? So if you know anything about the roots of the words, you can kind of guess to that. But people who have these primary immune deficiencies have a lot of morbidity, particularly from infections, but some of them have mortality if, in fact, they don't have the ability to fight a particular infection. And I have one exciting piece of news, which is that since we visited with her 5 weeks ago, Elizabeth has been admitted to nursing school. Wow. Pretty good, huh? She's very excited. So this summer, she's going to be moving to Tennessee. And so we'll have to get her hooked up with somebody there and get her going on everything. But I thought you would be interested to know that. And it's a really great point that even though people might have primary immune deficiencies that have a significant impact on their life, it doesn't stop her from living her life and doing what she wants to do. Okay, so that's pretty good, isn't it? Okay, so that's our review. Now let's kind of bring it home. A number of you in the audience are interested in maybe going into the health profession, so let's talk about some of the things that happen as patients and physicians and a few of the more common things. Okay, so if you have a patient that you're meeting with, and I'm going to say, in this case, the first person, because this is what I do. I meet with a person, I've been asked, is this person normal? Is there something wrong with their immune system? And let's say I diagnose someone with common variable immunodeficiency, okay, based on the tests that we do for that. What does the patient want to know? Okay, so let's just bring it down to brass tacks here. What does your patient really want to know? If you were that patient, what would you ask your doctor? Yeah, what's going to happen? You know, what's my fate? Am I going to be killed by this thing? How long will I live? You want to know sort of what's going to happen with you, right? Well, that's an important question. And for some things, it's fairly easy to answer. For some illnesses, and you've all heard, whether it's on TV or with a family member, some things like, say, particular kinds of cancer in particular stages, we've got a lot of scientific data that can give you approximate, you know, estimate of how long people live on average if they've got stage four particular kinds of cancer, right? Of course, there are always, that can be incorrect sometimes, and that's always a good thing when that's incorrect. But with CVID, that's a little bit harder. So I want to get into that a little bit as a physician, what we think about to answer that. So, doctor, what's going to happen to me? Okay, so then I'm thinking, how do I answer that question? Because this is kind of a complex illness for CVID. And so in the context of that, I think really what my patient is asking is, what's my prognosis? What's going to happen with me? And really in a more technical sense, the question is, what is my phenotype? And did you guys talk about that a little bit, genotype and phenotype? Okay, so for this particular topic, I want to get into that because my thought process about phenotype will help me to answer the patient's question, what's going to happen with me, okay? So phenotype, as a reminder, the sum total of your genetics and your environment and to a certain extent how those two interact with each other, okay? So it's really an equation. So here's an example. Let's just say for kicks that if I had two patients with exactly the same genetics, okay, they had, if I were able to look at their genes and they had exactly the same genetics, yeah, it could be identical twins, but if they both were given the diagnosis of CVID, they both had exactly the same genetics, but, of course, that's theoretically speaking, but one of them happens to be a preschool teacher in Oakland, which is one of my patients, and another one of my patients lives by himself way out in the middle of the Nevada desert, and he hates people, and he doesn't want to interact with anybody. Okay. How will that change their phenotype or the way that they manifest disease? So how do you think, even though they have the same genes, what might my response be? Based on this information, their environmental exposures. Yes, sir. So this gentleman points out very correctly that my patient who lives out in the middle of the Nevada desert is less exposed to organisms, bacteria, viruses. Can you imagine a preschool teacher with common variable immunodeficiency? That's like an immunologist's worst nightmare, okay? But yes, he's exposed to many fewer sick people, so he acquires many fewer infections, and if a person with a primary immune deficiency gets infection over and over and over, sometimes you get damage to the lungs, you're exposed to a lot of antibiotics, you're exposed to a lot of other health care, and so your ultimate outcome could be quite a bit different because of that. Does that make sense? So that's an example of where the environment may play a big role in how I would answer the question to what's my prognosis. So what am I supposed to do with the preschool teacher who loves her job? Okay, she loves her job, and she doesn't not want to work with preschoolers. You know, so there are risks involved to some of the life decisions that we make about what we want to do. And, you know, as long as we go into those things with eyes wide open, well, you know, I think that that's a decision that as adults we can make. Nevertheless, I do lose sleep about both of them. And even the guy in the desert, I lose sleep about him because he doesn't make any antibodies at all. You know, so there I am lying awake at night thinking he's not getting any treatment at all for this. He's just a sitting duck, you know. But yet, I hear from him once a year, "Hi, doc, I'm doing fine, no problem." You know, whereas my inner city school teacher, she has terrible lung disease and has had terrible problems. She's on oxygen, lungs are really very damaged, and it's been hard for her. So I think that example is clear. Now, yes. So the question then becomes sort of this love-hate thing, you know, and how might that affect the immune system? And I promise I did not plant this gentleman with that question, but we will address that a little bit later, okay? All right, so let's talk about another example, which is two patients in an identical environment. Okay, now how hard would that be, Imagine if you could get anybody to volunteer for that experiment. So you have two people who are in exactly the same environment, exactly the same apartment, exactly the same pets, exactly the same furniture, exactly the same carpets, family members, exposures, jobs, everything. Identical environments. But one has a defect limited to B cells and the production of antibodies, okay? Whereas the other one has that, but also T cell abnormalities of immune dysregulation. That's what can happen with common variable immunodeficiency. So how might their phenotypes differ? To kind of bring this home, let me show you this slide again. So if the defect I have in my immune system is right here in this B lymphocyte, my problem might just be I'm not producing antibodies and that's it. Okay? So I can probably kind of deal with that because we can give people antibodies. But in order for these B cells to produce antibodies, they need signals from where? From the T cells. And so what if the T cell isn't working right? Or the T cell isn't sending the right signal? If you have T cells that are not working right, you can get a lot of other problems, right? Because the T cells are involved in a lot of things other than just antibody production, some things as indicated here, okay? So the spectrum of CVID-associated health challenges includes a lot of other things, autoimmune diseases, several types of cancers, inflammatory lung disease, enlarged spleen. There are a lot of different conditions that patients with CVID can get. But so you can see my quandary when my CVID patient says, what should I expect? You know, what's going to happen to me? So the other thing to note, happily, is that 25% of CVID patients actually don't really get any complications at all. So why might a genetic analysis be helpful for people who have CVID? So there I am thinking to myself, I want to answer this patient's question. Doc, what's going to happen to me? So it's called common variable immunodeficiency, right? Because people can have any one of a variety of manifestations at different times of their life. They might have lymphoma, they might have multiple infections, or they might just be fine the rest of their lives as long as they get immunoglobulin, okay? So why might genetic analysis be helpful for people who have CVID? Yes, sir?
We can individualize their treatment variables, which variation they have.
Yeah, so if you know the genetics, then you can start to look at, does a person with this particular genetic pattern get these particular types of conditions? Okay? So there are probably many in the case, probably many different genetic changes in common variable immunodeficiency, but what I would want to know is there a strong correlation between the genetic profile and the long-term outcomes? So let's just say, for instance, and there are many more than 10 genetic profiles for patients with CVID. Right now we just kind of have this bucket that we call CVID, but there are probably many different types of genetic profiles that ultimately lead to this picture of what we call CVID. But let's just say we identified 10 specific genetic profiles. Then we can follow people over time. And let's say the person with genetic profile type 5 is always the kind of person who gets inflammatory lung disease and autoimmune problems. Okay? That would give me a much better idea of how to answer my patient's question, what's ahead of me? So as you've seen with environmental influences, it's not pure and clean, especially with illnesses that are not due to just one gene. These are kind of complex. But if over time I have specific genetic profiles and we can follow people, then I might be able to say, well, you probably have this profile, and of all the different manifestations of common variable immunodeficiency, here's what is most likely for you, here's what we can expect, and therefore, guess what? We can target preventive measures better for that person, right? Does that make sense? Okay, yes, sir. Yes, so the question is, does that mean that if we were to be able to identify all the different genetic patterns, would then that fall out of CVID? It's one of my goals that CVID will no longer be a diagnosis, okay? Because right now it's really a term that refers mostly to people who fail to make antibodies or whose antibody production is faulty in response to antigens. And so right now, CVID is just a bucket term, but if and when we're able to get these genetic diagnoses, if you know someone who wants to fund such a project, let me know. But yes, then we'll be able to state very specifically a different condition. And I will name the first one after you if I can. Because it's a great idea. Yes, ma'am. So the question is regarding the cytokines and some of the signals involved in the communication between the cells. We can actually measure some cytokines related to some cells. So far, it's not very helpful for this particular condition, but you are right that we can sometimes determine whether people are failing to make certain cytokines, or let me give you an example. There are some people who develop lymphoma, and you remember that cancer is a cell that multiplies. It's a single kind of cell, right? So it's not the genetic diversity of the body, but it's one cell that multiplies and multiplies and multiplies until you have too many of those kinds of cells. And if it happens to be a cell that produces, let's say, interleukin 5, IL-5, then you may end up with lots and lots of eosinophils. Remember that one kind of blood cell I showed you? IL-5, interleukin 5, stimulates development of eosinophils, and it prolongs their growth. And so, for example, sometimes I will have patients who come to me, and the question is, why does this person have eosinophilia? Why are there too many eosinophils in the blood? Well, what we call the differential diagnosis, meaning the possibilities of the diagnoses, can be very broad for that. But one of them is that they have a specific kind of cell, such as a cancer cell, that's way too many cells and it's just pumping out all this interleukin 5, a cytokine that causes development of eosinophils. And in fact, I've had a patient who had eosinophilia before his lymphoma was evident. Okay? So you're absolutely right that by looking at cytokines, we can gain more insight into some of the communication and possibly some of the treatments. There are actually some cytokines that we try to give people to compensate for certain types of immune problems. Yeah. Okay, another great question. Okay, so now let's switch to a few things that are even more down to earth. Some common questions that many of you in the audience who might become doctors, these are some questions that you may have asked your doctor, but will be asked as a physician. So let's go over a few of these because they're common and they're of interest to a lot of people. So, question number one, can I develop the flu from the influenza vaccination? Okay, what do you say, yes or no?
Yes.
I hear yeses and I hear noes. Okay, so really this question gets to the heart of what is this particular vaccine. And so I would just break it down by saying there are some vaccines that are live organisms, okay, such as measles, mumps, some of the viral vaccines, that are live organisms, but they have been beaten down, okay, so that in people with healthy immune systems, they cannot cause illness. Okay, so most people, when they get the measles vaccine, they don't get the measles because they have healthy immune systems. These organisms are what we call attenuated, so they're not really capable of producing disease. So those are live attenuated vaccines, and there's a whole class of them. You can look it up on Google. It's easy to find. So much easier than it used to be. Okay. But there are also non-live vaccines because we know that we can fool the immune system if it just sees, if it thinks it's seeing the organism, right? So with influenza, we don't actually give influenza virus. We can just give a couple of the things that are on the outside of that virus, which then trigger the immune response in humans, okay? So no, you cannot get influenza infection from the vaccine because the vaccine is not a live virus. Now, that's not to say that you can't feel the effects of getting the vaccine because the vaccine may wake up the immune system a little bit and maybe you get a little bit of fever with that or something else. But you cannot get influenza from the vaccine because you're not getting the virus. Okay? And I know I always have patients who say, I always get the flu every time I get the vaccine. What they might be getting is they might be getting flu-like symptoms, but they're not getting influenza because it's not a live vaccine. Okay. So that brings up another interesting question, which I go over all the time with our patients with primary immune deficiencies. This is a loaded question. Do you think patients with primary immune deficiencies can receive live vaccines? It's a loaded question. So the correct answer is no. Okay? So my patients with primary deficiencies of the immune system should not get live vaccines because in some cases they will not have the defense that they need to battle off even a live attenuated organism. Okay? So our patients with CVID, they can receive any of the vaccines that are not live vaccines. So I don't mind if they get a flu vaccine. They may not have much of a response to it, right? Because they're not producing antibodies, or they may be producing fewer antibodies, but it's not going to hurt them. So any of the non-live vaccines they can receive. So the answer to can I develop the flu from the influenza vaccine is no. It's not an actual organism. Can you develop some kinds of symptoms when you get the vaccine? Sure, but it's not from influenza infection. Yes, sir.
So what exactly is the intended continuation?
What is the
attenuation? So the virus can sort of revive itself?
No, it doesn't. But what it does is, so it's kind of a, in a way, it's kind of a shell of its original self, where all of the antigens, the important antigens on that organism are there, but it doesn't have the active machinery, the energy, or anything else it needs to do to actually cause the infection. So the immune system has the time it needs to develop a response to it. And remember, the immune system has memory, because how often do you need to get a tetanus vaccine? A long time. And we can measure active antibodies in people who can't remember, maybe even 20 years. Don't say that to your doctor. But you do need to have, we do have sort of regular intervals that we recommend. But yes, it's a live attenuated, so it's designed so that it has all of the antigenic features, but none of the ability to actually infect.
So if you give it to an immune system compromised person,
yes.
Then what happens? It can't reproduce, right?
Well, it depends on the virus, but some of them can. And an example of that might be, let's say, a polio virus. So it depends on the vaccine that you get. But if they have enough time in the human body, theoretically, they do have opportunities to eventually cause that problem if there's no immune response against it. Okay? Yes, in the back. Yeah, so is there a problem with getting vaccines too frequently than the recommendation? Generally, from an immunologic standpoint, not so much. But for example, with the pneumonia vaccine, there is a very small percentage of people who, if they get two of those vaccinations within a two-year period, they might get very large local reactions. So you can have sort of a more energetic immune response to that vaccine if you get it too closely spaced. But for most of them, no. Now, there are also things like if you get a TB test, you know, sometimes there are some people who, if you get those TB tests for tuberculosis, you know, the skin tests that you can get, if you get those too close together, it might give you not quite an accurate response. There is some concern about that. So in general, we don't worry too much. Let's say you're not sure if you had the tetanus 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and it's been 4.5 years, and you're about to go into a situation of high risk for tetanus. I wouldn't have a problem with giving that vaccine too soon. Okay? The immune system knows how to handle it. But yes, another great question. Okay, here's another one. Why do my lymph glands swell when I'm sick? Okay, why do you get lumps and bumps when you're sick? What's happening? Sorry, say again? Yes, that's right. They're working. They're working on your behalf. So if you get, let's say you get strep throat, there is a lymph gland right here that some of you have probably felt when you get strep throat that gets really big. You have an immune system. Congratulations. It's doing its work. All that stuff that I showed you about the T and B lymphocyte interacting, all that activity is going on and it's being stimulated. Okay? Now, that said, what is lymphoma? Lymphoma is when you have one of these cells of the immune system that becomes a cancer and grows and grows and grows and multiplies and multiplies. So, if you have enlarged lymph nodes that are not a consequence of an appropriate response to an infection, You might get enlarged lymph nodes from a lymphoma. So I do not want all of you guys going home and feeling all over your body tonight for enlarged lymph glands, because I know everybody does it, including myself. But just as an example of activity in lymph nodes. So it's a normal thing to have lymph glands that swell when you have infection. Okay? Yes, sir. What's increasing in volume? The number of cells, the activity of the cells, sometimes actual fluid, because if you have infection, you've got a lot of fluid that's coming and focusing in that area. So everything involved with the immune system, including probably a little bit of extra fluid. You know how when you get a really bad strep throat and you look in the back of your throat and it's kind of all swollen and red? That's fluid, and in part, there's more fluid because the immune system is focusing on that site right there and bringing lots of immune cells, and you also get some heat as well. Fever is another response that we have to sort of try and get rid of infectious organisms. So, yeah, okay, great. All right, next question. Why don't the bacteria on my food make me sick? Okay, someone asked this last time after we ended. So why don't the bacteria, okay, do you guys, when you get up in the morning, do you put all your food in a sterilizer?
No,
you don't put it in a sterilize it and steam heat it. I just found out recently that washers and dryers now have these steam cycles for sterilization, but you don't do that with your food, right? So undoubtedly your food has stuff on it, right? Sometimes stuff that's not so harmful and sometimes stuff that can make you really, really sick, okay? So what do you think? Why doesn't it just kill me? Well, you have an immune system. If your immune system is intact, what happens when you put it in your mouth? You immediately have a bunch of mucus that comes along. All those things we talked about with the innate immune system start to take place. Yes, sir, you had an answer for me? You were talking about the innate immune system was your answer, right? And you are correct. So all those things we talked about, innate immunity, I mean, really, would you want to ride down on a piece of bagel only to plop down in a whole bucket full of terrible acid? Doesn't sound like much fun, does it? So that's the innate immune system. By the way, the gut is the largest immune organ in the body. Okay? That's very interesting. Okay, one more. Can I take pills to boost my immune system? Everybody who sells them wants you to think so, right? Okay, people make a lot of money. And if that were true, I probably would not be a professor at the university. I would probably be out selling pills. But sometimes you can't do that. So the answer is generally not. Okay? And you know that already because you have seen how complex the immune system is, right? So there are some parts of your immune system on some occasion that you might want to have a little bit boosted. You know, like if you're infected with a certain organism, you want the specific part of your immune system that is capable of responding to that organism to be boosted, okay? But if you boost the wrong part of your immune system, what can happen? Autoimmune disease, okay? So an autoimmune disease is where your immune system is overactive in parts where you don't want it to be, okay? So it's overactive in recognizing, or I should say not recognizing you as you, and you're attacking yourself. Well, I don't want to boost that part of immunity. Another example might be allergies, okay? Allergies are hypersensitivity reactions. So anybody who's claiming to boost your immune system, your next question should be, well, that's very interesting. Specifically, what part of my immune system will this boost? Okay? And if they can't answer that specifically, and if they can't tell you why that is going to be good for you, don't buy it. Okay? And in fact, there are some things that can kind of give a general boost to certain parts of the immune system that you're recommended not to take if you're prone to autoimmune diseases. If you have, guess what, genetic propensity to autoimmune disease because mom has thyroid disease and dad had ankylosing spondylitis. If rheumatoid arthritis and other types of autoimmune diseases run in your family, you don't necessarily want to take a pill off the counter that's going to boost your immune system. Okay, have I nailed that one completely? Have I bored you to tears with my long-winded explanation? But I think you've got the point that you can't really just buy an immune system over the counter. Does ginseng boost one's immune system? Well, that's actually a good question, and I actually have studied ginseng, and I've actually done a clinical trial related to ginseng. And it's interesting because the results of my clinical trial in to see if it helped with in people who actually this involved influenza vaccination and whether or not they produced more antibodies, to specifically look at that as a measure of whether or not there was more antibody production in people who were taking ginseng. And the answer was no, not in that clinical trial. But as you know, there are lots of parts of the immune system, and I only worked on one specific one. There have been some clinical trials that have shown maybe reduction in influenza in community-dwelling seniors. So there has been a little bit of data looking at incidence of infection, for example. So I can't give you a strong answer, yes or no. My guess is if it does, it's not all that much. But as you can imagine, it's very hard to study every specific herb for, you know, all groups of people in clinical trials. Yes, sir, behind you. So the question is related to the yearly influenza vaccination. Okay, so this is how it happens. Every year, some scientists who are experts in epidemiology and infectious diseases sit around the table, and they look at what strains of influenza are circulating around the world, because they have to predict which are the most likely strains that will be coming and potentially affecting you next winter. Okay, so they have to make an educated guess based on which ones are out there, because as you know, there's a time lag to produce the vaccinations, right? So every year, the vaccine that you get for influenza is likely to be a little different depending on what's circulating. It used to be more local community, but now we have an international community, and so it's really around the world. We have to pay attention to what's happening in Africa and China and Europe and other places. So yes, the vaccine that you get this year might actually have some similarities to last year, but it might have some differences to last year. And there are terms about influenza related to antigenic, you know that term now, drift, which means we're expecting it to be a little different, or antigenic shift, which means there may be a major difference in next year's bug. And so they have to make an educated guess. And yes, you can get a little bit of ongoing protection from last year's vaccine, but we can actually measure the drop in antibody levels over time. So you can actually have a pretty good idea of how long the vaccine that you get each year will last. But the reason that you need one each year is because it's likely to be a different organism that comes around each year. It's not an infinite number, but as you saw, viruses are very tricky, and they can assume sort of different appearance and a different virulence every year. And this last year, we had a fairly virulent organism. The vaccine was really pretty well checked, and it worked pretty well, but there still were a number of deaths in the U.S. because of influenza. So, yeah, and it's not a perfect thing, but in general, it works pretty well. It's highly worth it. The question is, you know, what is the effect of those past vaccinations? And what kind of protection does it give you, and does that change your immunologic response? And I think really the take-home message I want you to have is that this year's vaccine is really important. Okay? All right, let's go on. We're almost done here, and I know that we're actually a little bit early, but we're almost done. And so I just wanted to touch on briefly, we can't talk about the immune system without at least mentioning autoimmune disease. And we've discussed this a little bit, but remember in our first talk, we had a vocabulary word that was tolerance. And remember I was talking about how your T lymphocytes go to the thymus, and it's a checkpoint there where they have to survive several different checks. And the checks are, you want your lymphocytes to be able to recognize you and be able to distinguish you from not you, okay, so you can recognize a pathogen. But sometimes these lymphocytes will be too much you. They attach and they don't let go, okay? So you need a good balance. And so you have to have these several checkpoints to make sure that every T lymphocyte you release into circulation for business is going to respond appropriately. Tolerance is the term that we use when you tolerate yourself And loss of tolerance might be that I'm no longer recognizing me as me. So if I've got thyroid disease, say Hashimoto thyroiditis, I'm producing antibodies. Okay, my thyroid gland looks like an antigen. I just love that I can use these terms with you now. My thyroid gland looks like antigen, so my immune system is producing antibodies against my thyroid gland. That's an autoimmune disease. They come in all different shapes and sizes, but loss of tolerance to oneself is key. It's usually used with respect to autoimmune diseases, but you could also use the term tolerance as an allergist immunologist. I also use it in terms of responding to the environment. Okay, so that's the last thing I want to talk to you about. I've got a couple of slides that I want to show you here. And that is, why are more and more people developing allergies? Okay, so we're getting a lot of... Yes, ma'am, question. Yes, so the question is, what causes autoimmune disease? So there is a whole huge network within the National Institutes of Health involving a number of institutions, including UCSF, to understand that question. Why do we lose tolerance? What is tolerance? What dictates it? Why do we lose it sometimes? How can we get it back? And so, again, your question is full of insight, and we don't know the exact answer to that. There might be some, here we go, genetic propensity to it, so it might depend in part on your genes, your genotype. And we do have examples of certain infections that can induce autoimmunity. So there are some examples of that as well. But ultimately, we don't have a simple answer as to what causes autoimmune disease and how can we make it go away. Okay? So we have some pretty good treatments for a lot of the autoimmune diseases, but really the goal is to get to the underlying understanding of what causes it so that we can prevent these things or treat them before they cause a lot of disease. Right? Okay. Okay, so more and more people developing allergies. When I was a kid, nobody ever talked about peanut allergy. You know, I never heard that term. None of my classmates had allergies to foods. That wasn't a topic that came up. You know, some of my friends may have had a little bit of hay fever, that sort of thing. We're seeing a lot more of hay fever allergies, what we call allergic rhinitis, asthma, those types of illnesses, food allergy, eczema, which is like an itchy red skin rash that can, but not always, is related to allergies. We're seeing that a lot more in kids. And now I'm starting to see it in the adults because the kids are growing up. So why is that? And this is yet another question that we're trying to address and understand because we need to try to address this right at the beginning. And I'm talking about maybe even in the womb, okay? In the pregnant mother, are there things that we can or can't do or should not do, exposures, that things that she should eat or should not eat to help prevent allergies in that child? These are very important questions. So we're starting to get some answers, although it's actually very complex. But there's some really interesting studies that I wanted to just tell you about very briefly, looking at what is the role of our early environment, okay? Bringing back a little bit of the environment here. And it turns out that dirt is probably good for you. And I'm sorry to say that because I remember how hard my grandmother and mother worked to keep the house clean, neat sheets, dirt out of the house, animals out of the house, to have a nice clean home, which seems like such a great idea. But in fact, there may be some things about certain types of dirt that are absolutely essential to train the immune system early on. Okay, and this is where the field of allergy immunology is so important because we focus on that immune system right from the start. If you look at the immune system in a 65-year-old, there's not going to be much that you can do about what's happened up until that time. But if we understand better what causes allergies, maybe we can prevent some of these atopic diseases or illnesses, allergic rhinitis, asthma, food allergy, from happening. So, in Germany, there is a professor called Erika von München who has done some wonderful studies looking at what is the difference in occurrence of allergies in children who grow up on farms, genetically very closely related to each other. And some of these small family farms have barn animals and some don't. Okay? And what she found was really interesting, that the kids in the family where the kids are growing up with barn animals, with exposure to them, have a very clearly lower incidence, lower amount of allergic rhinitis, hay fever, and these types of allergic diseases. So what do I mean by exposure to barn animals? Courtesy of them is this picture. Okay? This is what I mean by exposure to barn animals. You know, this is a small family farm, and you can see that this kid, right from the start, has exposure to cows, but it's probably specifically pigs and cows that make a big difference. Okay? And what has happened over the last 100 years as far as where humans live? Yeah, we've all moved off the farm and we all live in tiny apartments in the city where we get exposed to dust mites and carpet and diesel fumes, but we're not exposed to barn animals. So that's not an explanation for everything, but this is what's called part of the hygiene hypothesis, which you've probably heard about, which I simplified for you a couple minutes ago, which basically is that some dirt, in fact, probably is good for you because it might train your immune system in the correct direction, as opposed to the children who had no exposure to these animals, whose immune systems are making more of what this lady asked about before, the cytokines that induce what we call Th2 immunity, which is eosinophils, mast cells that release histamine. And you're familiar with antihistamines, right? Anybody who's got springtime hay fever symptoms is familiar with antihistamines. So it turns out that exposure to these animals is associated with lower incidence of allergies. Why is that? We have a lot more to learn, but I think our environment is important. Now, there are lots of smart people in the audience. I want you to solve the following equation. Labradoodle. I heard someone yell it out. Not quite yell it out, but I heard it, okay? Well, that's true. If you combine these two dogs, you might get a labradoodle. They come in all shapes and sizes, and no, labradoodles are not necessarily hypoallergenic, which is a marketing term. You can be very allergenic to or allergic to the proteins in the saliva of a labradoodle. But that's not the point of this. The point of this is we also have some scientific data. How fun is medicine? Scientific data that show that the benefit to the immune system of the dirt and germs of two dogs is approximately equivalent to the training that your immune system will get from one older brother. Isn't science great? It's my nephew, by the way. Okay, so with that, I want to summarize by saying we've looked at all this stuff. We've looked at the immune system, some of the specific components of it, what needs to happen, what can go wrong, but really, what can we do? What can we do to make our immune systems as healthy as possible? Guess what? Adequate sleep is really important. Okay, that's great to say to an audience of students and very busy people who have tight schedules and are up until late at night preparing their slides for the next day, that sort of thing. But adequate sleep, we have studies showing effects on the immune system in people who are sleep deprived. Okay, good nutrition. I mean, these things are not that mysterious. You know, if you eat a lot of good fresh fruits and vegetables, lean meats, the nutrition that your body needs, you'll get the vitamins, the minerals, the substances that your immune system needs to work properly. Okay? So nutrition is important. People who are very malnourished become sick and die. Okay? And one of the reasons is because when they're very malnourished, not only are they starving to death, but the immune system is kind of starving as well. Moderate exercise. Okay, notice I say moderate exercise. I'm not talking about marathon running because, in fact, there is some indication that after marathon running, there is a little bit of a problem with the immune system for a little while, but in generally healthy people, you bounce back. But moderate exercise really shows sort of impressive results about what it does to help the immune system. Okay. I know this is good news and bad news, right? The good news is that you have control over a lot of these things. The bad news is kind of things you know you need to do anyway. I need to eat better. I need to get some exercise and lose weight. I need to get some sleep. Enjoyment of life. This is what the gentleman was talking about earlier. People who enjoy their lives, who have family and friends, live longer. If you do things that you enjoy doing, whether that's singing or playing tennis or whatever it happens to be, we know that that actually has some measurable positive effects on immunity. And hygiene. So I put just the word hygiene because now we're talking about hygiene hypothesis, meaning it may be important what types of exposures you have when you're very young to, in a sort of a positive training way for the immune system. But as we get older, hygiene in the sense of when a lot of influenza is going around, you can help yourself by washing your hands, okay? If you are sick, wearing a mask so you don't cough in someone else's face and give it to them. So that kind of hygiene as well. And really, it's everything grandma told you to do. Grandma was right. Your mom was right. You need to sleep. You need to eat well. You need to eat regularly. Get some exercise. Take good care of yourself. Enjoy your family. Those are all positive things for the immune system. And that's good news. We have some control over those things. So a healthy immune system is not generally something that we purchase in a bottle. It's something that we make of ourselves. And hopefully, if we're born with the right genetics, and when we get sick, if we have the right antibiotics and have not developed resistance to them because we've all behaved correctly, we'll have healthy immune systems and be able to live a long, happy life. And with that, I think I will close. And those of you who would like to go, you're welcome to go. And those of you who would like to stay, I'd be happy to entertain a few questions. So we'll let people go for now.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.